This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 12th, 2021, and this is your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF. This is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. On our show today, the decades-long saga of James Dean Walker, a story that includes two guilty verdicts for murder, one death sentence, an escape, and a plea deal that resulted in a release. The story is the subject of this week's Pryor Center Profile with Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. At 1 o'clock this afternoon on Here and Now, President Biden's infrastructure plan calls for at least $100 billion to overhaul the electric grid to make it cleaner and more reliable in light of climate change. NPR's Here and Now, right after Ozarks. The Arkansas Chamber of Commerce and several other chambers of commerce are endorsing passage of Senate Bill 622, which would enhance criminal penalties for crimes motivated by bigotry and prejudice. Arkansas remains one of three states yet to adopt a hate crimes law. A statement from the Arkansas Chamber reads in part, "While this legislation takes a different approach than was originally envisioned, its passage will help protect victims of crimes that are motivated by the victim's membership or association with a recognizable and identifiable class of individuals sharing mental, physical, biological, cultural, political, or religious beliefs or characteristics. The passage of this bill, the statement says, will be an important advancement in Arkansas's criminal law and give prosecutors a tool to help combat crimes motivated by bigotry and prejudice." Chambers of Commerce signing the letter of support include Northwest Arkansas Chambers of Commerce, the Northwest Arkansas Council, the Greater Bentonville Chamber of Commerce, and the Harrison Chamber of Commerce. Governor Asa Hutchinson is defending his support of a bill banning transgender girls from playing on girls' and women's school sports teams. He spoke about his support of the recently signed bill while also defending his veto of a bill banning gender-related care for trans minors on CNN's State of the Union yesterday morning. Governor Hutchinson says the school sports ban was not an example of government overreach.
To me, that's a fundamental way of making sure girls' sports can prosper. But at the same time, you're sending a signal that trans youth does not care. And so when that third bill came to me, I said, that's too much. And this interferes with patient care. It interferes with parental decisions on an area that the science is continuing to learn more about.
Lawmakers last week overturned Governor Hutchinson's veto of the bill banning gender-affirming care for minors, including hormone therapy and puberty blockers. The governor characterized that bill as unnecessary interference into medical decisions. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 271 new cases of COVID-19 this weekend and no new deaths from the virus. Hospitalizations this weekend increased by 3 patients. There is a net gain of 1 more active case in the state than there was on Friday afternoon. Clouds tonight with a 70% chance of rain overnight, lows from the upper 40s to lower 50s, mostly cloudy tomorrow with highs from 62 to 67. With a chance of morning rain in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. When a global pandemic was declared a year ago, researchers at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Little Rock immediately began investigating ways to respond. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Shuk Mae Ho, Ph.D., Vice Chancellor for Research at UAMS in Little Rock, leads the Division of Research and Innovation. She says when a global pandemic was declared, researchers, faculty, and staff dropped everything to respond over the past year, with nearly $39 million in funding from federal, state, and industry sources. She says UAMS is well equipped to safely do so.
The facilities that we have to enable us to do this kind of research, because it needs, for example, a negative pressure rooms. Those are called biosafety level 3 rooms or biosafety level 2 plus or enhanced rooms.
but it was challenging at first, she says, given scant PPE, personal protective equipment, which was being hoarded, as well as shortages of reagents, a chemical used to detect, in this case, positive and negative SARS-CoV-2 patient swab test results. But over the past year, UAMS has conducted clinic and hospital-based, lab-based, and community-based research encompassing statewide antibody testing and multi-site clinical trials of potential new COVID-19 treatments.
And I think the most distinguished one is the current one that we are involving with the University of Vanderbilt. They are the leading, they are the lead institution. The study actually is funded by the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS. It's a $34 million grant, and we are part of the study. And they're supposed to actually look at recruited patients coming in to take the convalescent plasma that you that many of us have heard so much about and thinking that we can actually pass it on. So the study is called Pass It On. That means someone who already had COVID, their body will generate antibodies against COVID and can re-extract it, the plasma from those patients and transfuse them to and give it back and pass the immunity on to the sick patients.
That NIH study involves 1,000 patients nationwide, including in Arkansas. Ho says yes. Convalescent plasma therapy recently came under fire as a failed treatment protocol. However,
well, in the initial studies, a lot of these studies were designed to be treating very, very late-stage patients. That means they're very sick already. So basically, right now, the potential guidelines are testing them in a slightly more early, moderate symptom patients and see whether that will help. Now, since the results are not out yet, we're not supposed to comment.
UAMS researchers are also looking at N-acetylene cysteine, NAC for short, to treat COVID-19 symptoms. The supplement has been shown to have expectorant and anti-inflammatory properties. And a warning here, Ho gets a little wonky.
The reason why we get COVID-19 is because the virus was very smart. It hijacked a receptor, and this is an angiotensin-converting enzyme that we normally have on our lung cells, on our nose cells, and in our renal cells, and perhaps in the heart and the brain. So this particular enzyme is now being cornerstone called the ACE2. And this ACE2 is like the little keyhole. So the virus has a little key, which has many, and those keys are called spike protein. It's just sticking out, and they will come over to this ACE2 receptor and stick it in and open the door and sneak into the cell. So that's why I call it a hijacking.
When run amok, the novel coronavirus hijacks ACE2, a vital element in our biochemical pathways that regulate things like blood pressure, wound healing, and inflammation. That's where N-acetylcysteine may help.
Basically, what happened is when we have COVID, this angiotensin 2 will accumulate because the ACE2 is being blocked. And NAC could block the excessive production of angiotensin 2, which will cause our blood pressure to rise and also cause a very severe disease. So that's how come like we think that maybe NAC may reduce the pulmonary disease severity. So this is the principle. But it hasn't gone through a very rigorous and multiple clinical trials to show that it actually works.
Last year, FDA granted emergency use authorization to medical providers to use monoclonal antibodies to treat SARS-CoV-2 infected patients. The lab-produced molecules act as substitute antibodies. Monoclonal antibodies block the virus that causes COVID-19 from attaching to human cells, making it more difficult for the virus to reproduce and cause harm. With pharmaceutical grant funding, UAMS is working to develop a monoclonal antibody drug.
So it can be both a prevention and a treatment. And that's something that I think will have a lot of promise in the future. However, the studies are not finished yet, so we will not be able to answer that outcome question.
UAMS researchers are also looking at how the pandemic is affecting mental health.
UAMS, College of Public Health, has expertise to study people who have been released from jail and actually returning to their society. Now, this group of individuals are really under a lot of stress because under normal circumstances, they're already stressed out. Now they are in a COVID time. It's very challenging.
And UAMS researchers are also conducting education research on vaccine resistance among minority populations.
Yes, there are a lot of research right now that is on vaccine resistance. A couple of nursing school faculty have received funding to study the mental health states of the high-risk populations. And those fundings are coming from a nonprofit organization called the Patient Center Outcomes Research Institute, which is the Affordable Healthcare Derived Institute. And so we also have a couple of colleagues receive funding to compare the quality of telemedicine versus face-to-face medicine during this COVID time. What are the acceptance, what are the effectiveness, and how much a patient initially worry about they're not getting the diagnosis they want.
UAMS, with Arkansas CARES funding, is collaborating to expand digital medicine to rural and isolated populations during the pandemic. One of the most gravely COVID-19 impacted demographic case group in Arkansas are Pacific Islanders, specifically the Marshallese. They live intergenerationally and celebrate often communally. UAMS researchers collaborated with CDC researchers who visited the region last summer when many were dying.
Some of these barriers can be overcome by education. Others can be overcome by language. We have to overcome the language barriers. So we have translated many of these documents, consent forms, and information materials into their own native languages. So that's the first step. And then also sending community-based workers into the communities to help, which is a process we call community engagement, is very important.
The collaborative team devised interventions in Northwest Arkansas to not only help quell virus spread, but to improve COVID-19 testing strategies for Pacific Islanders and Hispanic populations disproportionately affected by the disease. UAMS Translational Research Institute back in 2019 received a 5-year, $24 million award from the National Institutes of Health and NCATS. The prestigious award has attracted new research opportunities, institutional collaborations, and industry partners, which ended up leading or assisting with numerous COVID-19 studies over the past year. To learn much more, search UAMS COVID-19 Research. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Arkansas Cinema Society, in partnership with the Women's Foundation of Arkansas, will host a virtual screening of Picture a Scientist Wednesday night at 6. The screening will be followed by a chance to ask questions of Dr. Lee Doyle from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, who has a PhD in obstetrics and gynecology, and Dr. Nisha Viswanathan from the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She is a doctor of internal medicine. It will be moderated by Anna Beth Gorman, executive director of the Women's Foundation of Arkansas. If you'd like to register for Wednesday night's virtual screening, you can visit arkansascinemasociety.org. And Arkansas PBS is accepting entries through Thursday for Student Selects, a young filmmaker showcase, which highlights the creativity and talent of Arkansas's kindergarten through 12th grade students. In addition to possible broadcasts on Arkansas PBS, students may choose to compete for the Arkansas Historic Places Film Prize. Entry information is available at myarkansaspbs.org/student-selects. Submission categories include, but are not limited to, documentary, narrative, animation, claymation, stop motion, music videos, and public service announcements. The Bentonville Film Festival will continue its Virtual Movie Monday schedule 1 week from tonight with The Donut King, the winner of the BFF 2021 Jury Award for Best Documentary. The film explores the story of a Cambodian refugee as he builds a multi-million dollar empire by baking America's favorite pastry, the donut. It's directed by Alice Gu. The virtual screening starts at 6, a week from tonight. There will be a live question and answer session with the filmmaker and the film subject afterward. And ahead on this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large, we spend part of our Monday with archives from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History and Randy Dixon. This Monday, a story that captivated Arkansans across half a continent and over more than two decades, revisiting the story of twice-convicted murderer James Dean Walker and the supporters who say he is innocent of the crime. That's still to come on today's Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Washington Regional Her Health Clinic provides personalized care for women by women, including wellness visits, prenatal care, deliveries, and more. Located in the Washington Regional Women and Infant Center in Fayetteville, wregional.com/herhealth for services, providers, and appointments.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Monday. Online shopping has been steadily rising for years. But in the wake of a pandemic, it's no surprise that e-commerce is booming. Now, Winrock International and the Walton Family Foundation are launching a project to help small businesses in Northwest Arkansas keep up online. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
As we inch ever closer to the hope of a post-COVID-19 world, you might look around and notice the landscape of almost everything has changed. And that's certainly the case for retail, because where people spend their money is shifting more and more to virtual stores. A Recovery Insights report from the credit card company MasterCard showed that in 2020, one of every $5 consumers spent in the U.S. went to an online platform. That's up from one of every $7 in 2019. And as online shopping becomes the norm, local brick-and-mortar stores need to have e-commerce options just to keep up. Lindsley Kincaid is the Senior Director of U.S. Programs at Winrock International, a nonprofit development organization based in Little Rock.
You know, we're seeing a lot of storefronts needing to move to online platforms to ensure support or success throughout the pandemic.
So Winrock's latest effort, the Small Business E-Commerce Local Learning Project, or SELL, is addressing just that.
You know, building and managing and maintaining a website can be daunting, and in good times, often comes with a high price tag, requires ongoing maintenance and upkeep. And so our hope here is that we're able to provide the support to these small businesses to get those off the ground.
The SELL program will work with 150 small businesses in Northwest Arkansas to set up online services and then train employees on how to manage and grow their e-commerce sites. Kincaid says the project is funded with help from the Walton Family Foundation and will be of no cost to the participants.
One of the biggest things that we really request is that the small business owner be willing to invest time and not money so that we can provide training both through workshops, which small business owners would be expected to attend. And those workshops are going to be focused on things like search engine optimization, but also, you know, business fundamentals. And so we would want that investment of time by the small business owners so that we can provide the necessary support to ensure survival through the pandemic.
According to Clutch, a market research firm, 46% of American businesses don't have a website or any online retail option. And Kincaid says while she believes the pandemic boosted online shopping as a necessity, she believes this trend will continue.
So we were seeing that before the pandemic. We're seeing it during the pandemic. I expect it will continue. You're losing access to additional customers. This project in particular is built around a platform that encourages small businesses to benefit from each other's customer base. So it's kind of an interesting approach to customer development. You know, we want them to thrive and survive so that we have really bustling environments all over the state of Arkansas.
She says incorporating these online services isn't just a smart move for businesses looking to make more revenue. The sooner businesses get online, the sooner the region's economy will see a sustained impact.
To see gross revenue increase, the numbers of customers served, numbers of employees, we would hope to see maybe as small businesses grow, additional employees brought on, but also retaining existing employees. So, you know, I think we're hoping really to see just an overall bustling small business environment that keeps those doors open and allows them to grow in the way they want to.
She says the Sell Project will give business owners and employees training with digital tools like search engine optimization, website building platforms, and social media, but will also help them reinforce business fundamentals.
One of the primary roles of that is to complete what we call a lean canvas, which is a one-page business plan that outlines problems and the solution for the small business. And we want to provide that one-on-one training to make sure small businesses are prepared with their own business plans. We're going to do that long-term consultation as well. We want to make sure that each business is getting something tailored to their need. The long-term mentoring and support will happen through kind of a cohort-based training, but it will be based on what each individual business needs so that we're solving distinct problems that are not going to be the same for every small business.
Kincaid says WinRock will start recruiting businesses in Northwest Arkansas this month to enroll in the program. And applications are available now for any small business owner online at sellnwa.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Two songwriters with deep Arkansas connections who have both played in Northwest Arkansas in the past few years are making a bit of news this month. Roseanne Cash, daughter of Arkansas native Johnny Cash, is devoting 100% of proceeds from her new single, The Killing Fields, to the Arkansas Peace and Justice Memorial Movement. Cash says she wrote the song during a volatile, heartbreaking moment in America last summer.
You crossed on Brooklyn Ferry, not a boy but not a man. Left behind the Navy Yard and your father's mislaid plans. I was at the other ocean and I could not get away from the flurry of emergencies. Every single day, there was cotton on the killing fields. It blows down through the years. It sticks to me just like a burn. It fills my eyes and tears.
And Lucinda Williams, who lived for a time in Fayetteville and is the daughter of poet and longtime Fayetteville resident Miller Williams, has had one of the most lauded careers in folk and Americana music, earning 17 Grammy nominations and 3 Grammy Awards. In the late 1970s, she released her first LP, Ramblin' on My Mind. And in 1980, her second album, Happy Woman Blues. Both records are being re-released next month by Smithsonian Folkways Vinyl Reissue Series. The vinyl reissues will be available May 7th. You can pre-order them now. You can find out more about Roseanne Cash's new single, The Killing Fields, wherever you find out more about music online, and more about the reissuing of Lucinda Williams' first two albums by Smithsonian Folkways at folkways.si.edu.
Shannon Servaz is a chemical engineering professor at the University of Arkansas, and for the past year she's worked with Now Diagnostics in Springdale to develop a rapid test kit to detect the coronavirus.
We started looking at the technology I was developing for influenza to consider whether it could be transferred to this new virus that we didn't even have a name for at the time, and that didn't really seem possible, so we kind of set that aside. And then in February, it hit in Italy, and that hit close to home for Now Diagnostics because that's where their European headquarters are. And so when they were getting hit the hardest in Italy, we realized we have to do something.
In the latest edition of Short Talks from the Hill, a research podcast of the University of Arkansas, Servaz discusses her work and submitting an emergency use authorization to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and how the rapid test kit is currently under consideration. You can find Short Talks from the Hill under the On Air and Podcast link at KUAF.com or at researchfrontiers.uark.edu.
I simply don't feel like I need to be locked up any longer. I've got a future ahead of me that I'd like to try to take advantage of. And this is why I'm asking for privilege of being granted some clemency.
This is Ozarks at Large. It is time once again to go through Arkansas's history with the help of Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, what did we just hear?
Hi, Kyle. Hi. This was a man by the name of James Dean Walker. And I thought we would talk about the case of James Dean Walker this week. Bottom line, he was a two-time convicted cop killer. He was a young, kind of well-spoken, charismatic person. He was in Arkansas from Reno, which is where he was from. He was partying one night in 1963 with his buddy Russell Cumpy, and they got into a fight at a nightclub and shot a guy, and they were in their car and were pursued by the North Little Rock police and pulled over south of town, and there was a shootout. And Gerald Vaughn, the North Little Rock police officer, or one of those involved, was shot and killed. And Walker was sentenced to death. He was stood trial, sentenced to death. There were some questions about some of the evidence, and they held a second trial the same year. This was in 65, and he was convicted again, but sentenced to life in prison. Mm. So that's where we are. He became fairly famous because he had a group of backers that really thought he was innocent and would protest and march. And then, of course, the North Little Rock police members were involved because, of course, one of their own had been killed and he had been convicted. But he became a model prisoner, and he was allowed this new trial and was transferred. And Jim Pitcock, who was news director and reporter at the time at KTV, caught up with he and the sheriff from Pulaski County when he was being transferred for his second trial.
James, how do you feel about being transferred to the state prison? Next move going to be?
As far as I understand right now, we're going to the federal district court on a writ of habeas corpus.
Do you think you'll have a chance there?
I hope so. I have hopes that we will.
What do you think will happen when you get down to the prison?
And what are you referring to?
Well, with all of the publicity on the prison, do you have any apprehension about going?
No, I'm going to go down there and be a prisoner for them, just like the rest of them. That's all I can do.
Sheriff, are you glad to get rid of him?
Well, we're never happy to carry anybody to the penitentiary, Jim. It's a thing that we have to do, and we get these orders from the courts, and it's necessary for us to do it. It's not a happy occasion for us to put anybody in the penitentiary, but it's a duty that we have to perform, and that's it.
James, any last thoughts before leaving for the prison?
No, other than I hope I come back and get a fair hearing someplace on this, because I'd like to see myself exonerated of these charges. I'm not guilty of them.
That's an interview from 1968. All right, so the murder of the police officer took place in 1963, 58 years ago. But this story evolves over several years.
Yes, decades even.
Yeah.
He became, you know, a model prisoner. He was actually a trustee. He became that trusted, I suppose, and was part of the chapel. And so he would speak to churches. He was allowed to go on furloughs, but he would every year ask for clemency and would go before the parole board. And it was quite a controversy with the North Little Rock Police, especially in 1970.
And so there's pro and con to the James Dean Walker parole controversy. The final decision, however, rests on the shoulders of Governor Winthrop Rockefeller. This is Claude Locke reporting.
All right, we're talking about James Dean Walker, who was convicted twice of murdering a police officer. There were those, Randy, who championed his innocence, but no one... Did anyone deny that he wasn't involved in the fight in the nightclub and what happened somewhat after that?
No, okay. No, not at all. And he was there when the shooting occurred. He, you know, there was all kinds of evidence that he had a gun, but there was not evidence that he ever fired the gun.
I see.
That's where the big controversy was. But, when he was up for clemency, even then-Governor Dale Bumpers had an opinion.
Concluded at this time not to grant clemency to Mr. Walker. This is not to indicate that that is a final decision on my part as long as I'm governor. It's simply a decision that I've made at this time. These decisions, let me say, they're very difficult for a governor to make. If you are a compassionate man, you have the utmost hope that people will be rehabilitated. And this case, I think it would be appropriate to say that there are many men in our penitentiaries who deserve consideration. This is not to say that any of them deserve any more or any less consideration than this case.
Interesting to remember that we are just a couple, 3 years away from the outgoing Governor Winthrop Rockefeller commuting all death sentences, even though Walker by this time had had a second sentence of life imprisonment without parole. But attitudes, I think, fair to say, in the early 1970s, a bit different than contemporary audiences might remember.
I would think so, definitely.
Okay, so Governor Bumper says no to the clemency, but Walker does not give up.
And Rockefeller had said no.
Okay.
To the clemency.
Okay.
So he goes before the parole board again in 1974, and this is actually James Dean Walker speaking to the parole board in his petition for clemency.
As I've said before, very simply, I'm not the same person I was 11 and a half years ago. I've come through quite an ordeal in my life. I was 22 years old at the time this thing happened. I'm 34 now. And I simply don't feel like I need to be locked up any longer. I've got a future ahead of me that I'd like to try to take advantage of. And this is why I'm accepting, asking for privilege of being granted some clemency.
And as you might imagine, police officers are going to not want someone who was convicted of killing a police officer let out.
Mr. Walker was convicted of the offense of murder in the first degree and was sentenced to life imprisonment. Life imprisonment is what he should have. Police officers put their lives on the line daily to protect others, and far too many are being assaulted and murdered. We must, for the sake of preserving our way of life, keep Mr. Walker and others like him in an institution.
We must set an example. So therefore, we ask you, members of the board, to give this matter serious thought and to deny Mr. Walker clemency.
That was a North Rock police representative speaking against Walker being released at that time.
All right, so we've covered about 11 years of this story so far. And Randy, this is going back. Was this a statewide, high-profile, ongoing story?
Absolutely. And in some cases, it had national coverage. But this is where it really gets interesting. You know, he was this model prisoner. They would let him go speak to churches. He was allowed furloughs. Then one day in 1975, he goes to speak to a church in Forest City, and he just doesn't come back. And so this is an interview with Tim Baltz from the prison system about his escape.
Well, Steve, we have checked out numerous leads and possibilities during the past several hours since James Dean failed to return last night. We have no new leads, no new information at this time.
Do you suspect that he has left the state?
That is a very good possibility this time, yes.
What does this escape do to his further or future chances of clemency or parole?
Well, it would probably have a very bad effect on his chances. Of course, he is a Class 1 inmate now. At his present status, you had to be a Class 1 trustee type inmate before you'd be even eligible for parole. This will probably have some very bad effects on his a bid for clemency, because he now is listed as an escapee, and of course the parole board and the governor does not look with favor on people with bad institutional records or with disciplinary problems.
Upon his capture, what action will be taken against him by the Department of Corrections?
Well, Steve, he'll probably face our unit disciplinary committee at Cummins on charges of escape or failure to return from furlough, and there's a number of possibilities that could take place from this disciplinary hearing. More than likely, he would be reduced to a lower class from Class 1, possibly be reassigned to the whole squad. There are a number of things that could take place, and really at this point, would hate to say what exactly the committee would do, because we don't know all of the circumstances yet.
Were there any indications that he was considering this?
Yes, Steve, in some of our checking that we've done in the last couple of hours, we have reason to believe now that he did make some plans and possibly some preparations during the last week while he was on furlough.
Do you believe the department was lax in its supervision of Walker?
No, I don't. James has been on numerous furloughs before. He's been across the state speaking to various church groups and religious groups. And when a person is on furlough, of course, he has to go through some very strict procedures before he is released. He has to have the permission of the local sheriff of the county that he's going to visit. And I don't think we relaxed at all. We were following our normal procedures.
It's so fascinating to hear this from 1975, because as we know, the furlough program goes through a dramatic set of restrictions over the next 25, 35 years in Arkansas.
Yes, and this may have been, you know, one of the main cases that really put it under the microscope, you know.
So,
but I went back to that interview with Jim Pitcock, and for years and years, he covered Walker. So, you know, I talked to him about his experiences with the convict, with Walker. And so he sort of picks up the story after he gets away.
So James Dean Walker disappeared, and not a word was heard from him for almost 4 years. And then word came that James Dean Walker had been arrested in South Lake Tahoe, Nevada. He had been picked up for a petty crime. And when the sheriff's office there at South Lake Tahoe submitted his fingerprints to the FBI. Word got back that this was an escaped cop killer from Arkansas. So they immediately contacted authorities in Arkansas, and Arkansas put a hold on him. Arkansas said, we'll come and get him.
So interesting. So he went to this church, you know, a sanctioned event to talk to the congregation, and then poof.
Disappears. But and then suddenly, in 1979, Pidcock gets a call that, lo and behold, they picked him up in South Reno, Nevada. And so Jim hops on a plane and flies out and got an exclusive interview with him in his prison cell out in Tahoe.
In walks James Dean Walker. Had not changed, his physical appearance had not changed one bit. He had been in South Lake Tahoe almost the entire time. When he went on furlough to Forest City, what he actually did was, after he spoke at one of the church there in Forest City, he headed for Nevada, and that's where he was from that area, and he started working in a shoe store, repairing shoes. That's what he had learned to do at an early age, and that he was working. And he had been out there the entire time.
I've mentioned this before, Randy, but it's amazing to me that KATV, remember they sent Jim Pidcock to Vietnam to talk to some Arkansans who were fighting then, and he gets on a plane here. Like, I'm sure that he picked up the phone and got the ticket at that moment. It couldn't have been a cheap flight from Little Rock.
No, it was a day's notice.
Yeah. It's an amazing, this tells me how big this story was in the minds of those in the newsroom.
Well, and it was big that he landed the interview. He went through, I mean, he jumped through hoops with the attorneys, with sheriffs, with all kinds of authorities to get this interview. Now, here's the deal. This is the ultimate, as we call a teaser.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the interview digitized yet.
Ah.
But I have talked to the folks out at the media reserve and asked for them to put a rush on the Jim Pidcock, James Dean Walker interview. So hopefully within the next few weeks, we can follow up with another part of this and have Jim's exclusive interview with this elusive criminal.
So, and one of the many questions I have yet, Randy, is, after the escape from Forest City, and he goes back to where he was from in Nevada, and then he's picked up, recognized, and picked up there, was there still, organized efforts to proclaim his innocence?
Oh, absolutely. And it was determined by a judge out of North Dakota. It was appealed. And he was granted a third trial.
Mm.
And through all of this, Judge now, Chris Piazza, who was the prosecutor, struck a deal. By this time, it's the mid-80s, and he is granted a third trial, and rather than have him stand trial again, and after reviewing the evidence, they decided to strike a deal. And he pleaded no contest to manslaughter and sentenced to 10 years. And since he had already served 20, that plus the escape charge, he was set free.
Wow.
So he was a free man. Now, to add on to all of this, I talked to investigative journalist and a columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, Mike Masterson, who followed this case for years. And many people say it was because of his investigative reporting that it brought so many things to light that he was allowed this third trial. But here's what he has to say about the innocence of James Dean Walker.
Of the cases I've been involved in over the years, that the Walker case was, in my opinion, the most egregious case of an injustice. You see, Walker was easily convictable. I mean, he'd been in some trouble back in Reno. He was young. He was a young, you know, punk kind of guy. And so whatever happened on the highway that night, he was the obvious and easy way to explain it.
So do you think he was innocent?
Yeah, I don't think he killed Officer Vaughn. I never did. After I learned, delved into all the testimony, and I don't think he killed that officer at all.
Okay. So we're going to hear more about this case, which has so many twists and turns, it's hard to believe that it isn't more readily remembered by more of us.
I know. And with a name like James Dean Walker.
Right. Exactly. All right. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. He brings archives to us almost every Monday. You can put Pryor Center into a search engine and poke around at other bits of Arkansas history. Randy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Kyle.
What in the world is a Cubawano? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager with NASA Goddard, and this is Scratching the Surface. Actually, the very first of its kind was named QB10, and the category, Cubawano, is rather a nickname. These objects are classical Kuiper Belt objects, which orbit way outside of Neptune at almost 50 astronomical units. But they have no resonance with Neptune. Resonance means to have a gravitational balance and rotation, like our moon to our Earth. For example, Haumea was considered to be a Cubawano in 2006, but further studies found it to be in resonance with Neptune. So now, it's just a dwarf planet. However, Makemake is a dwarf planet and the largest Cubawano. Now, Cubawano orbits are very inclined, just like Pluto. So the orbits go at extreme angles from the Sun, which mean the icy surfaces would have extreme melting and freezing changes. Some can get as close to the Sun as much as Neptune can. As of 2014, there are 473 objects considered to be Cubawanos.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the University of Arkansas and is currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hear archived segments at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. The top-ranked Arkansas Razorback baseball team is now alone in first place in the SEC West. Yesterday, Arkansas outslugged number 3 Mississippi 18-14. Arkansas won 2 of the 3 weekend games in Oxford and now is 9-3 in conference play. A 6-game homestand begins for the Razorbacks Tuesday night against Arkansas Pine Bluff. The number 8 Razorback softball team lost to number 3 Alabama 2-0 yesterday in Fayetteville. The Crimson Tide took 2 of 3 games this weekend in the series. Up next for Arkansas, a 3-game set at Georgia starting Friday evening. The University of the Ozark men's soccer team is claiming the American Conference Southwest Conference Championship. The Eagles defeated Concordia College 3-1 Saturday night and finished the season 7-4-1 and win the conference championship for the first time since 2003. Arkansas men's basketball freshman Moses Moody is declaring for the NBA draft. Moody was an honorable mention Associated Press All-American, a first-team All-SEC selection, and the SEC Freshman of the Year. The NBA draft is scheduled for July. Meanwhile, two former Arkansas Razorback women's basketball players are expected to be selected in this week's WNBA draft. Chelsea Dungy and Destiny Slocum could both be drafted Thursday. Fans will be able to watch workouts of some of the top Kansas City Royals prospects this week at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. The ballpark is the site of the Royals' alternate site before the minor league baseball season launches next month. A limited number of fans will be able to attend the workouts on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, with each workout scheduled to begin at 7 p.m. each evening. There will also be opportunities for fans to purchase tickets and attend the workouts on Sunday, April 18th, and Monday, a week from today, April 19th. However, those workout times have not been finalized and will be announced at a later date. Fans can purchase tickets for just $8 on a first-come, first-served basis. And a sports shout-out to a team on the other side of the state. This weekend, the Red Wolves bowling team at Arkansas State finished second in the NCAA championships, dropping the final match to perennial power Nebraska Saturday night.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum on the Square in downtown Bentonville. Scheduled visits are welcomed daily from noon to 6 p.m. WalmartMuseum.com to reserve your visit or for more information.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, a conversation with Dr. Jennifer Dillahay from the Arkansas Department of Health about vaccine hesitancy in Arkansas. Plus, our militant grammarian, Catherine Churls, selects some commonly misspoken words and phrases. Is it first come, first serve, or first come, first served? And, of course, she'll give us a quiz on those frequent mistakes. Plus, John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette will talk with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics, and much more. That's tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF. And if you ever miss an episode of Ozarks at Large, you can go to ozarksatlarge.com to find the show. Or you can subscribe to our free podcast through any of the well-known podcast distributors, or just ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent daily edition of our program.
Hi, it's Rachel Martin. More than a year into the pandemic, a lot of things are still on pause. Maybe you've added some new rituals for a sense of normalcy, a virtual meetup or an online fitness class. Staying connected is as simple as ever. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Morning Edition, every weekday morning, including tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. Also every weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30, local news from where you live, and at 6:30 and 8:30 every morning, Inside Morning Edition, Community Spotlight with Pete Hartman, placing a focus on nonprofit efforts throughout the region. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Dry Fork. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, and Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Timothy Dennis produced our show in his home studio in downtown Fayetteville. Contributors to this Monday edition of Ozarks at Large included Jacqueline Froelich and Daniel Carruth. Daniel Carruth's stories are produced inside the Karen Taha News Studio. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens and produced by Pete Hartman at KUAF. Additional content for today's show provided by our friends at KUAR Public Radio in Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find Daryl almost every afternoon at 4 o'clock our time, performing live and sometimes taking requests at his Facebook and Instagram pages. You can find us always online at ozarksatlarge.com. Individual stories and interviews there with links that will allow you to share those stories and interviews with people you think could benefit from hearing them. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Kyle Kellums from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. This is Ozarks at Large. Please take care of yourself. Get rest. We will talk again soon.